Hello and welcome to The Boundless Show this week. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, here in the studio with a representation of folks associated with Boundless, including Steve, Ashley, Mott, and Suzanne. Hello.
Hi, Lisa.
Hey, Lisa.
Hey. Okay, on the show today, we're going to be talking about work and integrity at work. Do you even have integrity at work? Hopefully you do. So we're going to talk about that a little bit. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if Steve and Mott do. We're going to grill them. We're going to give them a little quiz and see if they do. Otherwise, we're just going to fire them. Then we're going to move into an interview with Tim Challies of Challies.com, popular Christian blogger. So you're going to want to hear that with his top six Christian classics that you should read, many of which are in discussion right now over at his blog. And so check out those, as well as talking about a few contemporary things and the reasons why we should even listen to the classics. And then we're going to close out with our Q&A today, where Suzanne is going to join me to talk about eligible males in the church and what do you do when one of them likes you, but your friend likes him and doesn't want you to be interested in him.
Ooh, fun. Mm-hmm.
This will also be the topic for an upcoming reality TV show, I'm sure, on one of the major networks. So we'll Christianize it and make it our own here at The Boundless Show. But for right now, we're going to talk about the workplace. We are all currently in the workplace right here, taking a break in our day to be on The Boundless Show. Although I guess some of you guys, it's your regular jobs. So you're just here. I'm just taking a break. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk a little bit about dealing with integrity in the workplace. Now, you may all think that we have tons of integrity because we work for Focus on the Family, and that's probably true. We do. We are awesome. But for those of you that aren't and just have to deal with the corporate workplace where you're just a bunch of thieving, conniving individuals, we're going to try to help you. Now, Steve brought in the book Run with the Bulls Without Getting Trampled is the title. By Tim Irwin, who is a PhD, and it features a photo of himself there in the cover flap, dressed as a guy who apparently runs with bulls, which I did not know there was an actual outfit for that.
Mm-hmm. It's so, got a cape and everything.
Yeah, like a sash, like a little sash and a little like neckerchief thing, like he's in the Cub Scouts. But anyway, that's good. I'm sure that helps him do that better. So, but what we're going to talk about today is actually his, I just want to reference a little quiz that Steve brought to my attention here that he features in the book called Integrity Scenarios. And he lists a bunch of scenarios and you're supposed to go through and rank them on their wrongness, basically, wrongness to rightness. And he lists things like taking an extra 30 minutes at lunch to get a haircut, using sick leave to go to a ball game, telling your manager you finished a project even though you haven't, using a company credit card for personal expenses, of course, meaning you would pay it back later, shopping on the internet during work time. So there are a bunch of these. I think pretty much most things I just read off I've done, and I didn't think they were a problem. So that might be a little personal conviction there. I might need to go back and look at this. No, I don't. Obviously, except use sick leave to go to a ball game. Don't write to me and say, let someone know you haven't done that because you don't know anything about sports. But anyway, what, I mean, do you guys think that this is a growing trend among younger people in our generation? I mean, we know our fathers and grandfathers went, they punched in time clocks, they were there to do their job, and then they left their job at five. You know, Fred Flintstone dead, he didn't leave till the little whistle. So why do you think this even has to be addressed?
Well, I think it's something that our parents and grandparents worked in much more structured environments, that we typically get a certain amount of grace given to us in the workplace that other generations didn't have. Mm-hmm. And I think it comes down to, what do we do with that grace? Do we tend to really earn trust from our employers by being responsible with that extra trust they give us? Or do we try to push it as far as possible and end up really turning into slackers?
Yeah. Well, I think it also depends on the type of job you have. Like Lisa was saying, they had the type of job that you had come in, you'd punch the time card and leave when the whistle blew. And even if you were an executive, maybe they struggle with two martini lunches and different struggles than what we do. But the thing you mentioned, like taking an extra 30 minutes at lunch to go get your hair cut, it depends on what type of job you have. If you're a cashier at the grocery store, it matters that you're not there for those 30 minutes. If you have my job, you know, Steve will let me go get my hair cut probably.
Well, mine doesn't have a lot of hair to cut, so
he usually doesn't take an extra 30
minutes. That's true. I don't struggle there.
He just sits at his desk and cuts his hair. That's the problem. And then people have to clean it up.
See, that would be a great use of time.
multitasking.
Uh-huh. Well, I'd be curious here, if we were all to be honest, what are some things that maybe somewhere along our path that maybe we have cut a corner? I mean, I'll give an example. I was a yearbook editor in college, and we had a petty cash fund that we would use when we had a late night, we had a deadline to meet, and we could use to buy pizza and drinks or something like that. And I was a poor college kid. I didn't have any money. And so there were occasions where I borrowed from the petty cash fund to go see a movie with the guys and would pay it back. And I felt some tremendous guilt mm-hmm. over that. And finally paid it all back. I mean, actually, it reminds me, too, of my brother. He had a job, one of his very first jobs. He worked for this guy at had this farm center just down the road, and the guy had a gas pump. And he could fill up all his farm equipment with it. Well, my brother would fill up his truck with it. And it was like 8 or 9 years later, my brother had major conviction and showed up at the guy's house and gave him a check for, I don't know, $200-$300 to say, this is to make up for gas I got back when I was 16 or 17 or something like that. But I mean, it's something that I just remember back in the time, just this major guilt, but thinking it's probably okay. Mm-hmm. I think I can get away with it, which mm-hmm. is, I think, what most of us are thinking.
Well, I was just thinking, I feel like our generation is all about challenging the rules. So if there's just a rule in the workplace and it doesn't seem to make much sense, I think a lot of times it's easy to justify, you know, that's not really going to affect my output as an employee. That's not really, it almost doesn't seem like an integrity issue because the rule doesn't seem to make sense. And so I feel like that's where a lot of those gray areas come in. Like, well, if I know that the rule isn't really even achieving the benefit that the employer is going for, why do I have to follow it?
Well, especially with the online generation, I think one of the main struggles with our generation is surfing personal websites during work hours. And I know that I was in the workplace when the internet started, and it was a real struggle. I developed a habit of going on personal websites because there's always, well, you can always justify downtime, you know, it won't hurt 10 minutes here or 15 minutes there to go on. And today it's Facebook or something like that. But you have to get out of that habit. You just have to cut it mm-hmm. out altogether because it's not your time. You're on mm-hmm. someone else's time.
Well, I remember back during the 2000 election when you had the recount, and it coincided with this explosion of online websites covering every minute detail of the election recount. And I found myself thinking, well, I work in a job that's kind of related to this, and my job's actually this intersection of internet and policy stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I can probably justify spending 5 or 6 hours on mm-hmm. Real Clear Politics or some other website getting these updates. And then I realize, okay, this probably isn't right.
Yeah. Well, I was just hearing on the radio that right now, like with all the March Madness stuff, is the most unproductive time in workplaces of the year.
Oh, in fact, in Wall Street Journal just yesterday, they said the button that you can push that turns your brackets into a spreadsheet, called the boss button, was pushed 1.5 million times last week.
Oh, my word.
But, you know, awesome. Too, the issue of what you're doing online at work, what's the term they use for the Monday after Thanksgiving? It's like Black Monday or something because
Black Friday.
Monday.
The Monday after, they said
that's Internet Monday.
Online shopping mm-hmm. goes through the roof because people wait until they get back in the office where they have a high-speed connection mm-hmm. and spend a lot of the Monday after Thanksgiving doing their shopping. Mm-hmm. And then just the other day we had, after we interviewed Dr. Mueller, he was going across the hall to a studio to record his program, which was going to be about the spike in online porn viewing during
70% of all porn viewing happens during 9 to 5.
So, you know, obviously there's a lot of different varieties here that I can think the continuum. You've got some people out there who are thinking it's not a problem to view porn online. I think more people in our audience, it's going to be shades of gray, like how much should I maintain my Facebook page or how much is it okay to shop online during the work time?
Mm-hmm. You know, something interesting that I read about was that a lot of times religious people and Christians are more likely to cheat at work. and cheat on their time. And the reason that was stated was that we process things in a morally justifiable way. Hmm. So when we cheat, we tend to have a whole moral backstory and justification for why we're doing it, which I thought was fascinating.
Because I'm going to go online and read my online daily devotional, and it is about Jesus, exactly. And all my time is the Lord's.
Okay? Exactly.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Okay. Now, we actually received an email from a listener who was talking about the results-oriented workplace, which is hugely popular with our generation because it's basically you create your own schedule, you're responsible for what you have to produce, what you have to do, and how you get that done is entirely your business. If you want to do it in your pajamas, if you want to do it in 3 hours a day and just blaze away, or if you want to eke out a few things here or there and take 12 hours to do it, whatever. Personally, I love this idea. What do you guys think about it?
Well, I think it's a bad idea. I don't know. Maybe it depends on the job too, or the workplace, because I think there's something to be said for being available, being at the office, and especially being available to your boss. Like I feel like I need to be there during normal work hours in case something comes up, whether it's a phone call or whether, you know, Steve's my boss. So if he just wants to come over and chat about some project informally. So I think there's something to be said for being there, being accessible during normal work hours.
And so you think you can't do that via phone or just an iChat or something like that?
Well, you can. I don't think it's the same. I think that I don't think you get the same dynamic over the phone or mm-hmm. you know, texting or.
Mm-hmm. You certainly can't get gum or Advil if you need it. I'll tell you that.
Which is a whole other issue. Raiding the work medicine cabinet is a, or even office supplies. I mean, that's a whole other integrity issue people deal with in terms mm-hmm. of. You know, mm-hmm. what you grab. But you know, it's interesting. I think on the whole flexible and work, the results oriented, you know, the best way to do that is just to do freelance. Just be a mm-hmm. free agent. Because when you're a free agent, everything is on a contract. And it does come down to just getting the thing done. And you can work in your PJs and work from anywhere you want. But whenever you go to work with a boss, and they actually hire you and say the expectation is you're gonna be available, you're gonna be a part of this team, we're gonna give you all these benefits, then it does change the relationship, and there is a whole new level in terms of expectation of availability. And there are some jobs where it really does come down to, did you get those widgets processed? And those are the ones that's most likely you can find creative ways to do that. A lot of people in white collar world, though, it really does come down to FaceTime. You need to be available because you've got there's a lot of flexibility in your job. You need to be there when surprise issues come up. And there's all those things that fall into the category of other duties as assigned that mm-hmm. are just hard to do if they say, you know, we need somebody to tackle this, but the person's trying to do their work on the beach and they're not able to come in for it.
See, my problem is with the opposite scenario of what we just talked about. My problem is with the people who work 8 to 5 and that is it. And the clock watchers and the people who are, you know, this is above my pay grade and all that stuff, can't stand. I just want to fire them. Can't stand it. I mean, because I'm like, I would much rather have people approach their work. And granted, okay, we're talking about grocery store clerks. Yeah, if you need to be there and, you know, doing your job, then you need to do that, or doing some kind of a manufacturing kind of thing where you're on an assembly line and have a, you know, schedule to keep or whatever. But a lot of the workaday jobs, you know, I would much rather have someone have their Facebook up and be like checking their whatever wall posts and changing their status. Now I'm on a new project, whatever. I don't care about that. But I would like them to know, like I go home, you know, and there are some things, you know, I'll get an email from a reporter maybe in the evening or something, and I'll address it then, you know. Sometimes maybe I'll save it till the next day. But I find that if I approach everything a little more holistically, now for people with families, you know, you have to be like not just attached to your job 24/7, but I find that to be a lot more freeing than just the, I'm going to be there, you know, 8 to 5 is focus on the family's time, and that's all they're getting, and I'm bolting out the door, and then no one talked to me. I don't know. It just drives me nuts.
Well, I would expect both. I would expect an employee to come in and not update their Facebook and not spend personal time with personal emails during the work hours, and be accessible after hours if they're a salaried employee.
Crack that whip, Mark.
That's right.
Wow.
No, but you know, I think it comes down to this is an issue that's coming up more and more, is almost the fluidity of the work and home life, that I am seeing more people saying what you're saying, which is, if you're going to let more of work invade your personal life, then why shouldn't more personal life invade your work life? And I think in that scenario, and actually a lot of what we're talking about, it really comes back to trust, that employers typically know who they can trust, and those people get a lot of flexibility, and they're the ones who usually can get away with a lot of creativity with their time and what they do at the workplace. But then employers know who they can't trust, and I think it's because those people they can't trust that they don't just come up with company-wide policies, because they know some people will be good stewards of it, mm-hmm. and some people will totally abuse it. And, you know, I just one last closing thought there. If you look at the biblical examples of some of the best employees in the Bible, were Joseph and Daniel, that mm-hmm. they're really held up in terms of the level of responsibility, integrity that they had with the responsibility they were given. And they were given more responsibility based on the trustworthiness they showed. And that's why Joseph, when he's talking about Potiphar, he said, my master's given me, he trusts me with everything. He's given me responsibility for his whole household. There's nothing that he doesn't trust me with. Mm-hmm. And so I think if we just have that attitude, employers will typically give us a lot of flexibility.
I think a mistake that younger workers make is assuming that they can have the same flexible schedule as their bosses. Or even if they come in and they see their boss, like I saw my boss, Steve, on looking at a game last week, the NCAA.
Actually, I couldn't figure out how to get it in. All I could look at was the score.
I know, Steve, he wasn't doing that. I'm teasing.
Samant just went over to help him.
But just assuming that that gives you the same liberty to come in late or to leave early or to have the same flex time as your boss, then that's just not the case. I think that's a mistake to assume that.
I agree. Something that I struggled with when I was a teller at a bank, I would always see my superiors take two-hour lunches and, you know, just sort of goof off at work sometimes. That's what it looked like to me as a younger employee. But it wasn't. It was that they were salary. Sometimes they worked till 7 p.m. Sometimes they worked on the weekends. They came in on Sundays. And I worked 8 to 5. And I had a 45-minute lunch break. And that was something that I did kind of resent my boss for. And now working for you, Mott.
It's a bigger struggle.
No, it's not. I'm a little older, and I understand more about how hourly versus salary works. And I think of the parable that he told in Matthew 20, where the parable of the workers, they agreed to work for a certain wage. And I know that for working for folks in the family, I've agreed to work for a certain wage, a certain amount of hours a day, abide by certain dress code rules, and those are things that I'm, you know, not going to complain about. I'm going to give you the 8 hours that I've promised you. I'm not going to cheat you out of that. But I'm also going to have, this is a little pushback to Lisa, I'm going to have good boundaries. I'm an hourly employee. I'm not salary. And so, you know, if I get an email on the weekend that's urgent, sure, I'm going to answer that in my personal time. But if it's not urgent, I'm going to say, I'll wait till Monday to do that. Because I do want to honor my personal life. I want to rest, and I'm not going to work if I'm not salary on the weekends, unless it's necessary, unless it's a need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say too, Lisa, to what you said earlier about you wouldn't mind someone checking their Facebook or updating their Facebook. For me, maybe it's different for different people. For me, it would become a habit. At least that's what I experienced early on in my career. I'm easily distracted, and with the internet, wow, that's a dangerous combination for someone who's easily distracted to have the internet right there in front of you. So I really had to just swear it off. I can't do that. I have to actually, and there's always something to do at work. And you may think that there's nothing. There's just nothing to do right now on board. No, no, that's not true. There's always something to do.
If you're not knocking things out now, I mean, typically this is a problem for people who have flexibility, who know that they can probably get away with moving an assignment or project a little further out, that the temptation is to think, well, I can delay that so that I can do this personal thing now, but something else is going to come up. It's best to go ahead and keep clear decks, to go ahead and take care of things now so you got flexibility when a new project comes up the next week. And I think that whole inertia of bad habits is the key issue. I think that's something that Tim Irwin in this Running with the Bulls would come back to, is the integrity issue. When you start tolerating bad habits that accumulate and take on inertia of their own, it's actually, that's what makes you vulnerable to the big compromises. And it's almost like that broken window theory that says you look in neighborhoods, you tolerate broken windows, and it invites bigger problems, it invites bigger crimes. That maybe there is something to be said for going back to rethinking your boundaries, to evaluating the smallest area of compromise so that you don't open yourself to vulnerability for bigger compromises.
Yeah, I think it's possible. I think it definitely goes both ways. I was just thinking, you know, when I've looked at executives' job descriptions, you know, you'll find that most of them only have like three bullet points. It's always, you know, when you start out, you've got all these tasks that you have to do, and executives tend to honestly take people to lunch and go to meetings and make big decisions. And so you probably don't have to be somewhere 8 to 5 to do that. Just call someone up on the phone and do it, and, you know, bring home $1.5 million to do it. But but you also share a huge burden of responsibility, and if the company tanks, you're going to tank along with it. So,
but you'll probably get a $50 million bonus going down.
That is very, very possible. Yes. So I don't know. Yeah, I guess I'm kind of torn on it, because I definitely see the value of, and when I started out, you know, I was definitely in those jobs where I had to be there, and that teaches you certain responsibility, and it teaches you certain values that you need to keep, what it looks like to show up at something when you need to be there and remain in there. But yeah, I'm not a big fan of people, you know, I've always told my employees, I don't want you to sit around and act like you're being busy. You know, yeah, if you've got something to do, then do it. But at the same time, they know that when we have a big media event here on the weekend, they're going to be here. And, you know, it's just going to happen. So yeah, so I don't know. I mean, what do you all as listeners think of this? Do you have any particular challenges in your workplace, things that you've struggled with as far as integrity, just that little, you know, taking time here or there, grabbing a little stack of post-it notes, doing whatever you feel you need to do your job well, because that's how we all justify it is, you know, in order to do my job well, I need to have a 3-hour lunch so I can just recharge. So anyway, not sure what that looks like for you. And then two, what, you know, maybe share with us too, what your ideal working environment is. You know, what would that look like for you? Or what are you aiming for? Are you aiming to get into a position or a field someday where you can chart your own schedule? Or are you someone that likes kind of the structure of going into a job that has more parameters around it? So let us know. We want you to be part of the conversation.
I have despised my crown. I chose to place it down, running to catch the wind. Feet bruised and blistered now, from chasing shadows around, a maze of empty promises. Am I still within your view? Have I gone too far for you? Take me back to Eden. I've traded truth for lies. I've got no alibi, no excuses to remove this blame.
For this week's culture segment, we are joined by phone by Tim Challies. Many of you know Challies, Tim, through his blog, challies.com, where he, I guess, he describes himself as blogger, author, and web designer. And then his first book, The Discipline of Spiritual Discernment, is actually now available everywhere. So you're going to want to check that out. But we know you, Tim, through you've had some involvement here with Boundless here at Focus on the Family. You know our team well. And we're going to talk today about what you describe, I guess, as the Christian classics, a discussion of the Christian classics. And I think when I think of classics, you know, well, immediately I think of the, you know, David Copperfields and some of the old books that do have some roots in Christianity and whatnot. But you actually have a list of books here that you're going through almost in a book club fashion, correct, with people on your blog?
Yeah, that's exactly it. We've put together a list of books, or we are putting together a list of books, and just trying to go through it one by one, chapter by chapter.
Okay. And that's cool. So tell me, obviously, I mean, I've been a big reader in the past. There are still, you know, I guess I still read quite a bit. But what prompted you to even come up with this idea and bring your readers along with you in discovering these books?
Mostly selfishness. That's a motive in much of what I do, I guess. But I had realized one day that I just wasn't reading many of the classics. I was reading a lot of newer books and reading lots of references in those newer books to some of these classics. And it occurred to me that while I had lots of secondary information about these books, I had never read them myself. So I thought to myself I'd go ahead and start reading them, but I'm somewhat lacking in discipline and thought that maybe it would be wise to rope a few other people into the project with me. And from there, I decided to put it out on my blog. And then before I knew it, we had a few hundred people reading some of these books together.
Okay. And now when we refer to these books, some of these are actually pretty, now, you know, like you say, classics, but would probably be pretty obscure for some of the people in our audience. I mean, we have people who are, you know, in college, you know, pretty young folks who, for them, you know, classics are now The Purpose-Driven Life and some of these other books that have come out in recent years. But you have listed here, and I'm just going to read the six that you have on your list. You have Mere Christianity by Lewis, Real Christianity by Wilberforce, The Seven Sayings of the Savior on the Cross, Pink, Overcoming Sin and Temptation by Owen, The Religious Affections by Edwards, and Holiness by Ryle. Now, this is kind of like I see a little bit of a reformed who's who here. So what specifically? I noticed that in Real Christianity, I think it is, the original title was A Practical View of the Prevailing Religious System of Professed Christians in the Higher and Middle Classes in This Country Contrasted with Real Christianity. That just blazed me away, reading that.
Those were in the days before they had to have a picture on the cover as well.
I guess so, yeah, with the, you know, the appropriate author pose there. Yeah, if I read that title, I would not pick that book up. So what's the motivation for reading these books, Tim? What do they have in common, and what do we need to learn from them?
Yeah, well, I think defining a classic is a little bit difficult. Certainly there are books that last through the years, and you mentioned the word reformed, and in a sense these are, but in a sense as well, these are the books that have survived through history. They're books like Owen's books, Overcoming Sin and Temptation, Edwards, The Religious Affection. Sure, they're reformed, but I don't know that you'd find a non-reformed equivalent of this of books of this magnitude. Mm-hmm. So defining a classic, yeah, they're the ones that have lasted through history. And then when we get a little closer to our day, it's kind of projecting what will last through time. And a book like The Purpose-Driven Life, which you mentioned, may or may not make that step into history. Something like Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis is pretty quickly proving itself a classic, and it's still read, I think, as much today as ever it has. So I think that, even though it's fairly recent, it's still one that can be termed a classic.
Okay. So are you saying then these titles are pretty self-explanatory, like Overcoming Sin and Temptation, for example? I mean, what is this? Is this going to be like a 12-step program for doing that, or what will people find in this book?
Well, that's going to be a very, very heart-wrenching biblical look at sin and why we sin, who sins, and what to do about sin. And John Owen was an incredibly incisive writer and a very precise writer and a very verbose writer, so he can be a little bit difficult to read. The version we read has been modernized by Justin Taylor and Kelly Kapik, and I think it's quite a good version to read in that some of the language has been modernized and updated, and it makes it at least a little bit easier than Owen's original version.
Sure. Well, and it's not like we see books currently on sin and temptation flying off the shelves. So I think we do have to go back to books like these to really get a good, you know, a good reasoned and a true version of, you know, of those truths.
Yeah, for sure. And if you read something like The Religious Affections, if you want to understand John Piper, you can go back and read Jonathan Edwards, and you see just how much Piper is channeling Edwards, how much he's been influenced by him. So I think it's valuable for us to go back to these really, really important and foundational writers. And when we understand them, we see their influence in history. And I think somebody like John Calvin reading the Institutes would be another really good way of just seeing the kind of influence he's had on the church even today.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, obviously, many of us know, you know, due to the recent furor in the entertainment world of the movie Amazing Grace, we know Wilberforce from that. Many of us probably didn't know him well enough historically before that. But he wrote Real Christianity, and what's really the main message in that book?
Well, that's the one we're just into now. We're just three chapters in, but the subtitles to the modernized version, you gave the full title for the old one. Right now it's called Real Christianity. The subtitle is Discerning True Faith from False Beliefs. So it's about determining who is really a Christian and who is not. Now the idea isn't to start labeling all your friends and family members as Christian or not Christian, but Wilberforce's day sounded a whole lot like ours in that there were so many professed Christians, but very few who seem to show genuine marks of being saved. And so what he's trying to do is just show what a true Christian is according to Scripture and then what a false Christian is according mm-hmm. to Scripture.
Okay. The three remaining on the list, just, you know, just for our listeners who may not have read them, just give us a brief summary of Seven Sayings of the Savior on the Cross, Religious Affections, and Holiness.
Sure. The Seven Sayings of the Savior on the Cross by Pink is just an overview of, as you'd expect, the seven things that Jesus said on the cross, and he just has a message based on each one of those things Jesus said. Holiness by Ryle is, yeah, just a look at holiness, how God is holy, why God is holy, and how we, of course, are unholy, and then what to do about that. And Edwards, The Religious Affections, is, I guess, somewhat similar to Wilberforce in theme. He writes about religious affections or our love for God. And again, he's trying to determine what is a true love for God and what is a counterfeit love for God. And it, of course, came out of a time where there was great revival. And he's just trying to see who from that revival is really saved and who is just merely pretending to or merely perhaps thinking he was saved when really he wasn't.
Okay. And you referred a little bit to contemporary writers like Piper, for example, who are obviously well versed in the classics and as you said, kind of channel some of them in their own writings. What, you know, for people who may say, okay, well, there's a book coming out like every day in Christian book circles. How do I discern? I mean, is there even any value then in reading some of our current authors if we just, should we just go back and read what was originally said? Are these folks, these new folks, just reinventing the wheel?
Well, I think there's value in reading both what's new and what's old. Certainly there's ways people write today that are culturally relevant, that we have an easier time understanding, and that can speak to issues that are really troubling to us today. But there's also value in going back in history. And I think it was C.S. Lewis who said you should read several old books for each new one. I don't know if maybe you could even reverse that order, read several new ones to each old one. But I think we can have a kind of historical arrogance or contemporary arrogance maybe where we just feel that what's being said today is better or being said better than what was said before. Mm-hmm. And I think there's real value then in going back and trying to understand our roots as Christians. And certainly as modern Christians, I think we've really lost sight of our historical roots. I think it's well worth going back and revisiting some of these.
Mm-hmm. Well, in every book that comes out now, you know, you have the accompanying like day timer and bookmarks and all the marketing products that go along with it. So,
right. Yeah, I don't think there's a study guide for Jonathan Edwards, The Religious Affections?
No, yeah. No, right. They weren't sitting around out there in the fields, you know, pouring over those, I guess. So,
exactly.
Well, what in looking at these titles, is there anything problematic in them that you would pull out? Or as you've read them, you know, is there anything where you've just said, whoa, you know, and you've had to do maybe some deeper study or compare contrast?
Sure. Well, I think C.S. Lewis is an example of someone who had a few issues in his theology that most people are aware of now. There's just a few concerns people would raise with him. Most of the others, I think, have been pretty... I don't think too many Christians would be concerned with what's there. C.S. Lewis, yeah, I mean, you'll run across a few things. But, again, the point isn't to read only good books or only books that we're going to agree with everything. It's to read the classics, whether those are books that, you know, we'd agree with everything or we'd agree with nothing. The idea is just to go back and understand the books that have been hugely influential to the Christian faith.
Mm-hmm.
And sadly, not all of those books have been 100% orthodox, and of course, nor will they be in a sinful world.
Sure. And have you read all of these at this point?
All the ones you've listed, except Real Christianity, we're in the middle of now.
Oh, okay. And just in looking at these six titles, then, which for you has personally impacted you the most at this point?
I think probably The Religious Affections was the one that I got the most from. It was a tough read, and it comes in at over 350 pages, so it's a long read. But it's well worth wrestling through. It's not the sort of book you're going to get everything from in just one read. You'd probably want to go back through it again, and Sam Storms has written a good guide for it, a good guide to read in parallel with it. But, yeah, these old books are definitely worth wrestling through, even if it takes some extra time or you can only do it a few pages at a time.
Sure, yeah. Okay.
You'll have to mine out from there.
Yeah. Well, we'll definitely have to get folks into the books, and like folks know, Tim just said, they're in the middle of Real Christianity now. If you've read it or want to pick up a copy and read that and join the discussion at chalice.com, you know, make sure that you do that. Speaking of the website, Tim, you know, you're one of the probably most popular Christian bloggers out there, and you do a lot of book reviews. And I know you said, I think maybe tongue in cheek on your site, that you started by just posting family photos and hoping to kind of provide a forum for keeping up information on your family. And now you've kind of become this resource as far as Christian content that's out there. How kind of is that journey or that process going for you?
Well, it's sure been interesting, and yeah, it wasn't tongue-in-cheek at all. I just started the website. That's why I went with the family name, Chalice. I started it simply to show pictures of my kids to my mom, my parents. And as time went on, I posted an article, I posted another article, and through the magic of Google, those articles got picked up by the search engines, and people started reading them, and I just started writing more, and soon I found that I loved the writing, so I got rid of the photos, and I kept up with the site. So it kind of has taken on a life of its own. It's been quite an amazing experience, and I certainly didn't set out to create anything here or create what it's become, but I kind of feel like I've just been along for the ride.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, obviously our discussion here was on the classics, but you read and review a ton of books. What would you recommend to our listeners here? Something maybe or a few books that have come out in the last 2 years or so that you think are must reads for today's evangelical?
Sure, yeah. I think the best book I've read just in the last couple of months would probably be John Piper's Finally Alive. Mm. I think that's an excellent new book. And I know it's a little cliche to say read John Piper, but seriously, I think it's a really good book. And one, I think it's probably his best book he's written, and if not, very close to it. Well worth reading cover to cover. It just deals with conversion and how we can know that we're truly converted.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. I think there's a new one, just a new one out by Jerry Bridges called The Bookends of the Christian Life. That's one I read actually quite some time ago, back when it was in manuscript form, but it is an excellent, excellent book that just helps people understand, well, some bookends, two pieces of theology that can kind of help prop up the Christian life.
Yeah.
I definitely recommend that one as well.
I go to church with him, FYI. I just had to name drop.
All right, you go ahead and name drop.
Yeah.
How good his books are.
Exactly. Well, I have to get into Respectable Sins. He gave me a copy of that, and I'm just like, yeah, I don't want to read this.
Yeah, that's a good one, too. It's classic Jerry Bridges. I think The Bookends of the Christian Life is, he's written some books that are really well known and are, very quickly becoming classics in their own right. Then he's written some that, maybe aren't quite as impactful, but I think this one's right up there with some of his best.
Yeah. Most of our listeners know, I actually went to Bethlehem Baptist, too, when I lived in Minneapolis, and I'm kind of a John Piper Uber fan, but have you met him personally?
I have.
Does he not just scare you?
A little bit.
I mean, he scares me.
Why does he scare you?
Because I feel like every time I talk to him, I'm just, like, worthless. I mean, I'm just like, the guy's running around in a $5 blazer, and he like knows half of the Bible by memory, and he's always just quoting scripture. And I just feel like every time I remember when I attended the church, every time he even spoke to me, I was just like, I didn't even know what to say, and I just was a freak. So he scares me.
When you meet people that you respect so much, yeah, sometimes it's a little bit intimidating.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been great, Tim, to chat with you. Again, we want to make sure we're going to have the classics here that Tim mentioned that we talked about today posted at boundless.org, so you can check them out. The conversation is going on at chalice.com. That's challiescom. Again, you're going to want to check that out. Just find out not only regarding the classics, what Tim has been talking about, but just what he deals with on his blog every day there. Very popular. And we've always benefited from your wisdom and kind of your insight into what's going on in the culture and what's out there, what's being read, what's being said. And we're so pleased to have you as a guest here today, Tim.
Well, thanks. It was my pleasure.
I'm standing at the edge of something beautiful, but now dreamy are the eyes through which I see. I tiptoe this borderline and feel the rain through the sunshine. I'm balancing apathy and dreams. So speak, speak to me now. I'm just about to go to bed and rest my weary soul now for a while. So speak, speak to me now. The candle's burning out. It's almost time to say. I look to my left and right as a flicker like candlelight, and I'm remembering warmth of a deeper blue. I say a prayer and I watch it rise and disappear in the December sky. Light of man, come and descend on me. And speak, speak to me now. I'm just about to go to bed and rest my weary soul now for a while. So speak. To me now, the candle's burning out. It's almost time to say.
Opening up this week's inbox, I'm in the studio with Suzanne again. Hey, Suzanne.
Hey, Lisa.
All right, well, we're going to go ahead and address, Suzanne and I were just kicking it here about some fragrance gripes that we've had, which our listener would find helpful, for, you know, perhaps, because it's another boy crazy dilemma. So we're going to go ahead and see if we can help her, and if we can't, we're just going to go tell her to buy perfume. So she says, "Dear Boundless, there's a limited number of eligible males in my church, but all of them are great godly men. My best friend likes one of these guys, and though he has given no clear indication of returning these feelings, she has declared that none of us other women are allowed to like him. It appears that he may be interested in me. I'm interested enough in him to give him a chance if he were to step forward and make a move. My dilemma is this. How much do I sacrifice for the sake of a friend? Is it fair to this man to turn him down based solely on the fact that my friend has unreciprocated feelings for him? That just feels wrong. After years of praying for a husband and having never dated as of yet, it seems foolish to slam the door shut on my first opportunity. I have no desire to hurt my friend, but this whole thing seems childish. What do you think?"
I think this is a very common dilemma because as women, we do tend to, when there's nobody in the picture, we tend to sort of stake our claim on the guys out there. So I don't know about you, but I've definitely been in this position, probably on both sides, actually. And I think the best thing to do is to proceed cautiously, because you don't know if the guy is going to make a move. So there's no reason to just make a big deal about it before anything happens.
Right.
You can kind of just take it one step at a time. But at the same time, I think she's on the right track that you don't necessarily want to rule it out just because your friend staked a claim on him. I mean, I had a college professor who ended up marrying his college roommate's girlfriend after they broke up, you know, but he had gotten to know her through his roommate. And they ended up being a perfect match. So it's a good thing he didn't rule her out.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, this is interesting. I mean, I think I've probably been here like in my head before, but I've never had the guts to just tell someone, don't be go near him or whatever. but it is interesting. But I have had, in fact, I've had a couple friends deal with this recently. And really, it's, it, you know, I've had to kind of put on, you know, a hat of the, you know, you feel like you're putting on this like older sister hat or something, because it's like, really, if you are a believer who is trusting your future to God's best, and you are doing, I mean, it's not like you're just sitting back, you are actually doing what you need to do to make yourself available, to put yourself out there, to be interesting, be yourself, it may not be with this guy.
Right.
And quite frankly, this guy may be the best fit for this girl. And so I kind of leave it at a, you know what, if it's meant to happen, it should happen.
Right.
And we shouldn't put like state claims on people. And because usually all that is we're just dealing with our own ego. And it's mm-hmm. basically, you know, because you can't ultimately end up with everyone. And so, you know, you certainly, it's wrong and unhealthy to have everyone then just be pining after you
yeah.
too. I mean, that's not good. Other people need to move on as well. So, but I mean, I've literally had friends or roommates have conversations where it's like, well, you know, he turned me down. So, you know, if he ever asks you out, you know, I know that because you're my friend, you know, you'll say no and stuff.
Wow.
And then it's very, you know, can be very, then all of a sudden there's no one left because everyone has some weird connection to someone.
Right.
Or past disappointment.
And I think, I mean, it can be childish, mm-hmm. like she's saying. And I think try to rise above it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, don't participate in that kind of staking your claim conversation. I've had friends who have done that and I will listen. But in my mind, I'm thinking, you know, God's in control. And if he draws me together with this person, then I will cross that bridge when I come to it with that person. And generally, those conversations have tended to go very well
mm-hmm.
for me when it has come to a head on either side where it's like, we need to talk about this because we're kind of both interested in the same guy. The conversations have gone well because I think when you can sit down and reason with someone, you can get past sort of the junior high
mm-hmm.
mentality and kind of come to that common knowledge of, yeah, God is in control of this and we can get past this.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it is. I think there's nothing wrong with at least opening the conversation now with your friend just to say, you know, theoretically speaking or kind of from a philosophical viewpoint, you know, really, what do you really have a problem with this? And where is that? Because if the situations were reversed, you know, I would certainly want to put myself in a position of just saying, hey, you know, because it's very, again, it just gets back to, we don't know what God has for us at this point. And as men pursue, I mean, we want to encourage them in that. And you can't have them walking through this labyrinth of weirdness of
right.
just, you know, she's off limits because 7 years ago, her boyfriend told my, I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like, yeah, we need to just, you know, do what we can, realize that not everyone's going to be a great fit for us. Not everyone's going to like us. And that is okay.
Right.
Because we only need one person to like us, people.
And also just realizing that anything that feels like this friend drama, God can overcome that.
Right.
If you're meant to be with this guy. So just, you know, try to be respectful of everyone involved, but don't let yourself get too sucked into the drama.
Right. Exactly. And I know in my situation, when I was in love with John F. Kennedy Jr.,
mm-hmm.
the Lord just took him away from me.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Sometimes that happens too.
That happens too. And that's what happens when you have a bad attitude because, you know, he got Carolyn Bessette and I was totally jealous. And then the Lord took him and neither of us have him. Mm-hmm. So that is not helpful for this listener. But anyway, that is it. Suzanne, thank you so much for weighing in on that. That is it for this week's show. Again, we want to hear from you, editor@balnus.org. Please write to us with your questions and your comments and just anything funny that you have to say. We're heading into spring and we're all getting a little bit of spring fever, you know, just waiting for summer. So do write to us, do contact us, listen to past shows, let us know what you think, and we'll be here again next week with more content for you. And until then, for The Boundless Show, I'm your host, Lisa Anderson.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.